Good evening. I'll wait till Dominic goes, since there usually are quite a number of people who like watching these lectures, so I want to make sure that the sound works. Sound works? Can I leave this here? Hopefully I won't, or maybe hopefully I will pull away and smash it, since I'm not a lover of technology, even though I'm surrounded by it. Thank you for coming out this evening. Lots of faces I don't know. I wonder if that means I've got librarians in the audience. No? Any librarians? One. I apologize now. I'm going to say some hard things about libraries. It's not all love. My mother's a librarian, so it won't all be bad. So all of you have come out on a very warm evening to hear about libraries. That's a very hopeful sign. Interesting. All right. Well, I'm William Fahey. I teach at Thomas More College. I also serve as president. Welcome to Mercy Hall, formerly called the Anderson House, formerly part of Mercy Academy. And I hope that if this is your first visit, you'll come back for some of our other events. If I've got light shining in my eyes, so if I'm doing that, it's not you. It's that I'm dealing with very bright lights. Hopefully I won't collapse from heat from those lights. If I speak at this level, can you hear? Clark, can you hear me if I speak? All right, good. So I am not a professional librarian. Dominic's introduction mentioned that I've visited lots of libraries, but I'm not a librarian. So why am I in any way qualified to speak on the subject? Why am I speaking on libraries? In part, I'll be honest, when we were putting together the lectures for the summer, I intentionally went last in coming up with a topic because I wanted to see what sorts of things weren't being covered. And I thought libraries. But why libraries? Libraries have been on my mind for quite some time. Their place in society, how they work, how they don't work. I have five children, so I've spent a lot of time in different places taking my children to libraries, and I sort of have developed different kinds of lenses for looking at the buildings, looking at the collections of those things we call libraries. But let me give you two stories to reinforce why I think I might have something to say about libraries that hopefully will be interesting to you. So first, let me talk about Aristotle. We all know Aristotle. One can't really conceive of Western civilization or Catholic thought, in particular Thomism, without Aristotle. But the transmission of Aristotle's works is quite interesting for those who are concerned or interested in libraries. Aristotle himself was one of the first systematic collectors and designers, collectors of books and designers of a library. And he bequeathed his own library to his close disciple and key student, Theophrastus, who took over the direction of Aristotle's school, the Lyceum, in Greece. Theophrastus had Aristotle's library, and when Theophrastus was older, he then gave that library of about 10,000 papyrus scrolls to another friend who had been a student of Aristotle, named Neleus of Skepsis. Neleus was from this tiny village, Skepsis, which is in western Turkey, not on the coast, but near the coast. And he took all of Aristotle's works and all of the first editions that Aristotle had for his great academy into this little village in the hills in Turkey. And they more or less disappeared for quite some time. Skepsis is remote. Neleus was very interested in studies, but his family really wasn't, although they revered the books and they kept them. Now, Alexander had planted a seed in the mind of one of his most exceptional students. Not one of his brightest students, but certainly one of his most exceptional students, Alexander the Great, who went off and conquered most of what we now call Turkey in the Middle East. And it was a vision of how libraries could function as a leaven of culture and how you might want to organize learning. And Alexander's successors love this idea of a library, of trying to use a library to forge a new culture. And so another one of Aristotle's students, with a lot of money from one of Alexander the Great's successors, became involved in building the great library in Alexandria. And that library was like Aristotle's library on steroids. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that library in a moment. But let's go back to the highlands of Turkey. Some copies of Aristotle's works were made, but most of the original editions, as I said, were in this little remote village in Turkey. And when the family that owned those heard there were building projects to build these gigantic libraries, they took all of Aristotle's works and they put them in pots and they threw them in a ditch. And they didn't tell anyone they had them. And then when the collectors went away, they brought them out and they kept them. But they kept them and they were largely unknown for about 200 years and almost lost entirely to us. Now, at the beginning of the first century, these more or less rotting copies of Aristotle's books were bought by a book merchant named Pelikon of Tios, who thought he could make money by republishing this lost author. Many of Aristotle's works did make it to, in copies, did make it to the Library of Alexandria, but there's nothing like this collection. So he tried to rush out a mass-produced collection of new books of Aristotle. And this has caused problems that exist to this day for scholars trying to figure out what Aristotle really meant. Basically rushed copy, but these made their ways into various libraries. The original somewhat moldy Library of Aristotle remained more or less intact, but the professional librarians never made good use of it, nor did the professional Greek book merchants. It basically took a somewhat thuggish Roman general who thought books are pretty nifty and smart people have books around them. Sulla was his name. When Sulla conquered Greece, he transferred all of Aristotle's books back to Rome, and he arranged in his household for a man to edit them all. And the man he brought in was another Greek. It was a Greek, in fact, who claimed he was of the school of Aristotle, who very patiently edited the works of Aristotle for this initially home library of the Roman general Sulla, who was in no way a scholar, but appreciated and valued books and wanted to have the best books for his private library. The opportunity of putting all those books in the library at Alexandria moved no one. And as a result, the secret library, the little family library in the Greek highlands, meant Aristotle didn't have much of an influence on Greek thought for nearly two centuries. And most of his most important works, or at least what Aristotle thought his most important works were, which were scientific works, were lost to the Greeks, and only later restored in the first century. Now I'm going to come back and use that story as a sort of touchstone for some comments later. Second little story, more about me. I was born in 1967. Next week I turn 52. That means I am perfectly situated to give this talk because, like anyone who's in their mid-50s, I'm perfectly situated between two big generations. The boomers on the one side and Generation X on the other. Not really part of either of those groups. I participate in both. And if you have that vantage point, it means that you have a very different appreciation for certain social institutions and technology, which means when it comes to libraries, you have recollection of something that most people in Generation X, and certainly all millennials, have no understanding of. So when I was a little boy, this morning when I was writing up my thoughts, I actually thought, well, what do I say about why I like libraries so much? And two things immediately came to mind. One is, well, my mother's a librarian, and it would be wrong to be disloyal to your mother. And she instilled a great love of books and libraries in me. But one of my earliest memories as far as school goes, is I remember my third grade teacher, Mrs. Sherman, it's kind of a joke in our family, always threatened my children that we're going to go to the library where they're going to have to work on projects with Mrs. Sherman. But Mrs. Sherman's real. So when my children always say to me, is Mrs. Sherman real? I can honestly answer, yes, I'm not making Mrs. Sherman up. But when I was in third grade, Mrs. Sherman, I can remember her taking us to the school library at St. James Catholic School in Wyoming, Ohio, which is a suburb. I think it's now been absorbed by Cincinnati. And I can remember going up what, in my mind, is this dark tower, which I think was probably a two-story hallway. It was maybe four turns going up to the library. And the library had globes in it. It had books that I wasn't allowed to look at. It had wonderful windows with views of trees. And it was very, very quiet. And I have the happiest memories of whenever we as a class were allowed to go up or taken up to work in the library. That very much formed my imagination early on of going to the library, as did the local public library. Just about every day in the summer, my mother would take me down to the local public library. And that was just a magical place. I can remember very distinctly having story hour. Some libraries maintain this tradition of story hour. And going downstairs to the room where they had story hour, and it being decorated with Chinese lanterns and dragons, and having an hour where we listened to Chinese fairy tales. And that just being a very beautiful experience, and a simple way to get an eight-year-old to think about culture, the issue of culture and cultures that are different than your own. And as I grew up in high school in northern Ohio, in Hudson, Ohio, I spent an enormous amount of time in our public library in Hudson. And again, I have an almost romantic set of memories for things which are simply unknown to, I think, people in their teens, 20s, probably 30s, or even 40s. The sound of the library, to me, is the sound of sitting at a table and there being absolute silence apart from the periodic sound of the rubber stamp. But some of you may remember this. You had to be absolutely quiet in the library. It's so strange, these kind of crone-like women who always seem to be librarians, at least in my memory, they're always these old ladies, always scolding you and telling you to be quiet, but were secretly very sweet and nice. They were allowed to be terribly noisy. So banging these stamps. And the tradition of, I was thinking about this, the tradition of, I could give a whole lecture on checking books out. Now, those of you who are above the age of 50, remember before our obsession with secrecy and privacy came in, you could easily know everyone in your community's reading interests. Just go in the stacks, pull out books, and pull out the card. Because every time you checked out a card, you, with a pencil, had to sign your name to that and then turn that in. At a certain point in my life, I remember getting the metal stamp card where they then took that, put your card in the machine, and they punched it, and that went into a file, and they stamped your book on your way. But there was a record that you checked out that book. There was a kind of public accountability in the community that was the library. And I loved this. I loved this because when I would look at books, I was always fascinated to see who read them before me. Because I would often know these people. This became very important to me in college, to see, to find books that my professors had checked out, even some books my professors had checked out when they were students. This is entirely gone, and I vaguely remember it being abolished for reasons of privacy. I'm not sure why we have to be private about the books we check out, unless we're embarrassed about the books we check out, or there's something to hide. Libraries, to me, as a young man, a little boy, were wonderful places that lifted the burden of the present moment from you. They represented something outside of what was on the street, outside of time. They weren't nervous. They were very stable. They were very hierarchical. They were very communal. Community was defined. You couldn't check out books unless you signed things or had a card. And even then, St. James Catholic Library, there is a whole section of books that have really interesting book, I remember there was a book I wanted to check out on the British commandos. I was 9 years old, and I was told I wasn't old enough yet to check that book out. Now, the effect of being told you may not check that book out was a key contributor to my being an avid reader and wanting to kind of chip away at learning and reading and earn the privilege of getting to go into the next section of the library. I didn't feel like I was being denied information in a bad way. I thought, well, I haven't earned the right to that information. Libraries were a wonderful place and a very different place than they are now. There's some things about the modern library that are the same, but I'm going to end up emphasizing some things which have disappeared and changes. All right, now what do we mean by library? I was afraid, is my friend John McCarthy here? No, John McCarthy isn't here. So whenever my colleague John McCarthy hears me give a talk, even if it's an offhand short presentation, he always asks me to define terms. Because he went to a college where they believe, if you define the terms, the argument's good. I had Jesuit educators, so I realized defining terms can be part of a rhetorical maneuver to trap your opponent. So we come at this from a different angle. But let's define a few terms. The talk is on libraries and on culture, the culture wars. So let's just talk about the word library. Library is a fascinating word. It's old in our English language. It's derived from Latin. Some of you who had Latin probably know or can guess it comes from ultimately the word liber, the Latin word for book, which actually meant bark, not book originally, which tells us something about the nature of Roman scrolls or books, that they were wood shavings. And the Anglo-French introduction of the word library is derived from another Latin word, librarium, which meant a traveling case that you would put books in. I bring this up because there's a question on, is a library a collection of books, or is it a place? How physical is a library? At least this is a question that I wrestle with and think with, because it's a big question in discussions of what a library is today. So the word points at a kind of tactile, personal, defined area for books. In English, library, we know, is first used in the 14th century by two poets who actually were friends, Chaucer, some of you may know Geoffrey Chaucer, and his friend John Gower, both 14th century men. These are two earliest known uses of the word library in English. And Chaucer uses it to describe the room in which books are stored, but his friend John Gower uses it to describe the books themselves, not the room. So we have a room and a place, and we also have the books. Behind the Latin word is a really great Greek word, bibliotheca. And this word is sort of moved into modern European languages, but it comes from the Greek. And the Greek is a fusion of biblos, which means scroll, book, and theke. Theke is really awesome. So if you want to know what a library is, listen to the Greek etymology. Library is a biblical or a scroll book case, can be one meaning of teke. Can also be a book coffin, because it was the same word in Greek. Case, coffin. Bookcase, book coffin. The third meaning of teke that's very common is scabbard. What you put a weapon in. So book scabbard. Now for me, because my training is in classics, I love going back to the roots of words, and it seems that Greek meaning points to three possibilities for what a library is. It could either be a dead coffin for books, could be something that's weaponized, to use a modern term, or could be the place that books are systematically stored. Now, if you look up or study libraries, there's a pretty standard history of libraries. It goes something like this. Libraries appear around the year 2600 in the Near East. It's always the East that has the kind of creation of the library. Libraries are created in 2600 by the Sumerians, or maybe 2000 BC by the Egyptians. But when you dig into these libraries that we have, they've been excavated. A lot of them are actually in the University of Chicago or the British Museum. They're simply gigantic collections of receipts. Information about who is the courier for some message. Lists of things in storerooms. So the most ancient quote library is nothing but data. That's the Sumerian collection. There's not one word of literature, politics, or history in there. The Egyptian collection does have lists of the names of priests, but again, it's largely data. It's information that's been stored. The standard history will then point out, the next great library was found in the 1850s during the excavation of the palace of Sennacherib, when 30,000 tablets of Ashurbanipal were discovered. So a great, again, another Near Eastern library. But of these 30,000 tablets, 29,990 are financial receipts, government tax records. 10 tablets out of all those 30,000 have anything that would interest you. If you've ever heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh, it's on the bulk of those 10 tablets. There's 10 tablets out of 10, not 10K, 10 tablets out of almost 30,000 that have anything to do with the human spirit. I would not say that these are the origin of libraries. Those are the origin of data collection, which has a kind of antiquity and is interesting for people who are pushing libraries as places to aggregate and collect data. There is some antiquity to that, but that's not what I mean by a library. I mean, as I said before, the creation of Aristotle, the systematic collection of works used for intellectual and moral formation related to learning and a school, the centerpiece of the Lyceum. And as I said, the initial collection of Aristotle was the inspiration of Western civilization's most famous library, which is the Library at Alexandria, which I'll comment on now. The Library of Alexandria, as I said before, was the creation of one of Aristotle's students. He barely knew Aristotle, but he had gone to the Lyceum. And he was paid a lot of money by King Ptolemy to develop this notion of a systematic collection of books for the sake of moral and intellectual formation. And what he created was the museum in Alexandria, which had a library with it. And so when you hear about the Library of Alexandria, really what you're hearing about is the museum. It's a pretty interesting place. The museum had lecture halls. It had a dining hall. It had a visitor's center where you could stay for months if you wished. It had rooms for dissection. It had a zoo. It had botanical gardens. It was like a giant research center. It also had attached to it a library for literary, philosophic, scientific, religious, historical texts. And it was very ambitious what they attempted to do. These are Greek speakers. They had a Greek collection, was the centerpiece, but the goal was to collect every known published work in the world and to centralize it, have it all there in one spot so that people could refer to it. And it's at one point, by the first century, it's thought that there were 500,000 works there. Works in Greek, works in Latin, Persian, Assyrian that had been translated into Greek, works in Hebrew. There are even Buddhist texts from the Far East that were there. Again, the idea was to concentrate learning and have a massive research center, part of which was the library that stored those works. Again, I want to emphasize, however, though the library in Alexandria is Aristotelian, it's not like the Lyceum. It's not like Aristotle's library or his school. His school had a few dozen people, and only those people had access to those books. It was not a gigantic, public, concentrated research center. Now, the Greek world loved this idea of public libraries. And every king wanted to have a similar library. Every tyrant wanted to have a gigantic library. And so there were several others that popped up. But the greatest remained Alexandria. But there was a problem with this concentration of information, and it's the problem that always comes when we institutionally concentrate things and try to build out something that's large and powerful. It may become large and powerful. It's also very fragile because it's in one place. And the fate that Alexandria suffered was the fate of a very pluralistic city with a lot of rioting, a city that had a lot of wealth, a city that was in the sort of cockpit of several empires contesting with one another. And so there were a series of fires, sieges, that diminished the size of the library at Alexandria. One of the famous early ones was under Julius Caesar in 48 BC, but there were several more in late antiquity, in 270, 391, 415. But there was still a great library there. There was still a great library there until the 7th century. In the 7th century, when Amru ibn Asim, who was the general of the Caliph Omar, successor to Muhammad, conquered the city, he was approached by those within the city who said, "Here's our wonderful library." He had no notion of really what this meant, the library of this scale. He'd only seen smaller versions. So he wrote to the Caliph, Caliph Omar, who was both the political and religious head of Islam at the time, and said, "This is a massive library. What should we be doing with it? It's filled with pagan works, Christian works, Jewish works, works of science. What should we do with this?" And Omar said, "Everything in that library is either contrary to what's in the Quran, therefore heretical, or it is simply stating information that's in the Quran, which contains all truth, therefore redundant. And so the library is superfluous." And he gave orders for everything in the library to be burned and used as fuel for the bath system in the city of Alexandria. And apparently it took about 6 months to burn the entire library of Alexandria in the 7th century. The problem here is it's all concentrated. So in 6 months, because of one ruler's approach to learning and libraries, the most significant library in the Eastern Mediterranean is simply lost, gone forever. They have to start all over again. The Western Mediterranean, the Roman model, what will become the Christian model, is quite different. In the West, there's not a single catastrophe that wipes out learning. Libraries are very decentralized. Libraries in the Roman Empire are something that aristocrats like to have, especially on their villas. Villas should all have excellent collections of books. Villas and Roman aristocratic families should all be involved in their cultural and patriotic duty of producing manuscript copies, sending those as gifts, and putting them into circulation. Our collections, for example, Virgil, all come from villas, Roman aristocratic villas, that were in the business of copying these manuscripts. They didn't come from state or public libraries. They came from private collections. And this tradition is taken over by the Benedictines directly, because the Benedictine monastic model is very closely modeled on the ideal of the Roman country gentleman in his villa. So many of the things that were in the villa, many of the ideas of self-sufficiency, of having a certain kind of community that's ordered in a certain way, are derived from the Roman aristocracy. Now, I simply want to emphasize the old Catholic appreciation that most of us are taught in school for the monks saving Western learning is very true, but again, that tradition is sitting squarely on a Roman aristocratic tradition. The libraries that sustained Western civilization in the West from the second century until the invention of the printing press were very, very small. And it's worth meditating on this. Small but fiercely loved. It's a 12th century saying, "A monastery without a library is like a castle without an armory." Again, we have this image of the library and learning as a kind of weapon for defending a culture. But they're small libraries. It's like the two finest libraries in England in the 12th century. The Library of Durham Priory and the Library of Canterbury, associated with the cathedral. Durham Priory had a total of 300 works in its library. Canterbury, the see of the British Isles, or at least of England, had 200 volumes in its library. That's it. Ancient famous libraries like Monte Cassino might be in the low thousands, but this was very rare. If we go to 13th century Paris, we think of St. Thomas Aquinas. What did he have at his disposal? When St. Thomas is lecturing the students and expects them to go to the library and read, how many books at the end of the 13th century are available at the University of Paris? High watermark of Western civilization. If you feel warm when you hear the words Thomism, Thomism rests upon a university library system where a university like the University of Paris has 138 books that can be lent out to students to read. And it has more in some of the religious houses, but it's a very small number compared to the numbers we think of now as being necessary. And if you think of the achievement of Western civilization with libraries in these numbers, that's rather impressive and worth considering. The greatest technological change to affect libraries, at least prior to the internet and social media, was the printing press. The historian and librarian of Congress, Daniel Borstein, calculates that prior to the Gutenberg printing press, there were books in all of Europe numbering in the thousands. It may have gotten in the low tens of thousands. By 1500, there were 10 million books in print. So we go from all of Europe, 1400 years of preservation of texts, the total content of books in the thousands, maybe in the tens of thousands. Printing press within a few decades has brought the total number of books, the estimate is up to 10 million. And major libraries now would hold tens of thousands of individual titles. But that technological shift, unlike the technological shifts today, I believe, only deepened what I believe is the tendency of Western libraries towards decentralization. Although you did have libraries entering into a kind of biblio arms race, where the Spanish king was going against French cardinals to see who could have a bigger library pushing up into tens, 20, 30, 40,000 books, the real winners of the printing press were individual families and individual collections. That's where the bulk of the purchases were, and that's where the real growth was, small libraries. If we turn to our country for a moment, on the Mayflower. Imagine whatever you have in your mind about the Mayflower, the pilgrims, whether they were doughty, adventurous, religious zealots. Most of you have seen the size of the Mayflower ship or model of it. It's not much bigger than this floor. In fact, it's about the size of this floor. Everyone's packed on that ship and is going off to a strange place. And they can only bring a certain number of things with them. Many of them are faced with the choice of, do I bring books or an extra set of clothing? In almost every instance, they chose books. William Brewster brought 400 books. That's one pilgrim. He brought it's probably the largest collection, but he brought 400 books on the Mayflower. He didn't know what they were coming to. I think I'm bad. My wife thinks I'm terrible when we go on trips and I take half a dozen books. Imagine getting on the Mayflower 400 books. In Jamestown, after the initial catastrophe of Jamestown, when they write and they request a new minister in 1620, they tell the minister, you don't need to bring your library. So many people have died and they've left their books to the community. We have hundreds of books to give you when you come over. You'll have the communal church library ready when you arrive. Books were very, very important. But again, the scale was small. The idea was everyone should have a library. Communities should have very defined purposes for their library. And even if we think of the architect of the public library system in the United States, or the person who makes it possible, Andrew Carnegie. The American public library system is made possible by a Scottish capitalist. Carnegie gives $40 million, and this allows him to build, or allows to be built, about 1,700 libraries throughout the United States, and 100, and endows 100 college libraries. He doesn't pour all the money into one project in one significant town. It's decentralized. So even the largest injection of capital in the history of the United States is an injection of capital that promotes decentralization. Now, I think in the history of libraries, there's this tension between massive scale research project and decentralization. But I believe that the dominant tradition in Western civilization is to love the idea of a library, but a very communal library, a very personal relationship to the library. Now, what's been happening over the last 20 years is different. Now we are interested in things like the digital public library movement, or perhaps the greatest undertaking, the undertaking of the University of Michigan and Google to digitize every book and make it all available. Internet archives. I don't know if any of you use these things, but most scholars do. And I can remember being in graduate school when this occurred, and the promise being everything is going to be digitalized, so nothing will ever be lost again. Of course, it's all going to be digitized by one big corporation and one major university, but that's okay. We'll all have access to it, and so you don't really need to worry about individual books. I brought some things with me. Here's an example of one of the casualties to the digital. This is G.K. Chesterton's book, William Cobbett. It's not Chesterton's most important book, but it is an important book, and it's a very interesting book. This book, like probably a third of my Chesterton collection, comes from the Catholic University of America. I'm going to try to avoid naming most universities, but I'm a graduate of CUA. I love CUA, and if someone from, if President Garvey should hear my lecture, then he can look into this. CUA, when I was a graduate student, just threw out books. I used to get books and take them to the librarians and say, is this really 10 cents? This looks like this is a G.K. Chesterton book. It's in good shape. It's all being digitalized. We don't need it. This morning I got on to see, does CUA still have any copy of this book? At one point it had six. Maybe that's too many of Cobbett. Right? It has one now in the rare books room. In all of Washington there are three. In all of New England there are about 18. In all the New England states there are 18 copies. That's okay, because it's all digitalized. Now, if any of you have purchased books that have been digitalized or have used digitalized books, you know that the casualty rates on these books is remarkable, because there was some work-study student who did the work. It wasn't done by a scientist or a librarian. It was usually done by some underpaid work-study student who sat with an old-style Xerox scanner doing this. And I cannot tell you the number of books that I'm reading online, or I have in a printed copy off of the digital copy, that has someone's hand on it. Or, we've all had this happen to us, you're making a Xerox and you hit the button, but then you do the shift, your timing is off, so the book is kind of there, but maybe a quarter of the page is smeared. No checking has been done on this. Lots of promises of checking, but I would say, every time I give a talk or write something where I use digital books, I find a mistake, where a page is lost to me. And major research libraries got rid of books based on the promise that we'll concentrate on all the stuff through the digital, then it'll be available to everyone, and then it will be okay. Well, it hasn't been okay. When we break from the decentralized tradition, it typically is not okay. Again, the argument is usually information is growing so fast, there's so many works, there's so much knowledge, we don't have rooms in our libraries anymore. Now, I'm going to ask you to do a number of experiments. One of them is, I challenge you to go to whatever is your local public library and look at the shelf space. Most of the books are gone compared to the books that were there 10 years ago in most of the libraries I know. They're just gone. What's the shelf space for? Why do we need space, and why do we need so many books? Again, Thomas Aquinas' students made do with 138 books. The founding fathers of this country had no library that was larger than 7,000 books. I sat in my basement today, which is where my wife has exiled most of my books, and I did a shelf count, and then I went upstairs and did a shelf count, and I have something like 7,000 books. Now, I don't have a big house, and I'm not wealthy. I'm an academic. I love books. So I have as many books as the founding fathers. I have, I don't know how many times as many books as were at the disposal of Thomas Aquinas or Aristotle. We're fooling ourselves if we think that my possession of loads of books makes me very, very wise. But I hold on to the books for a variety of reasons, not simply because I want the information in it, but for other reasons. I'll come back to that. So, libraries, systematic collections of books organized around a defined community located in a specific place, and that place is designed for the encounter with those books. Where does all this come from? What's at the root of this culture of books? The Greeks had a culture of books, but they lost their learning. The Romans had did something down to us, but the Christians significantly changed it and infused it with something. Now, I want to read you a long quotation by Pope Benedict about this. This is an address he gave in Paris a number of years ago. And he's talking about the creation of European civilization, and in particular, the role of the early monasteries. And he said, it was not their intention to create a culture or even to preserve the culture of the past. Their motivation was much more basic. Their goal was to seek God. Amid the confusion of the times, in which nothing seemed permanent, they wanted to do the essential, to make an effort to find what was perennially valid and lasting, life itself. They were searching for God. They were searching for God because they were Christians. This was not an expedition into trackless wilderness, a search leading them into total darkness. God himself had provided signposts. Indeed, he had marked out a path which was theirs to find and follow. This path was his word, which had been disclosed to men in books, in the books of sacred scriptures. Thus, by inner necessity, the search for God demands a culture of the word. Because the biblical word of God comes towards us and we towards him, we must learn to penetrate the secret language of books, to understand the word in its construction, and in the manner of its expression. Thus, it's through the search for God that the secular sciences take on their importance, sciences which show us the path toward language. Because the search for God required the culture of the word, it was appropriate that the monastery should have a library, always pointing out pathways to the word. So Benedict makes an observation there that libraries are particularly unique to Christian communities because of our relationship to the Word, which is Christ, and the Word, which is Scripture. And that makes Christian civilization very different when it comes to books and the storage of books. Now, I'm going to skip some of my talk. Maybe I'll come back to it in discussion, if some of you stay for discussion. But I want to now turn briefly to modern libraries and some of the major problems in modern libraries. Exhibit B. Discarded. The Yale Shakespeare edition of The Tragedy of Julius Caesar. It's in perfect condition. The binding is relatively tight, indicating it was read but not overread. I have the Yale edition. I bought it for 50 cents, the entire edition, in a brown paper bag at a local public library. This morning I checked, because I had a kind of twinge of guilt. Before I say anything terrible, maybe they got rid of the Yale edition in order to get a better edition. The library from which I purchased this and the other volumes of the Yale Shakespeare has no edition currently of Julius Caesar. It doesn't need to, of course, because it's in the consortium. Some other library has it, but they have no edition of Julius Caesar. They do when I put in Julius Caesar and do a search in the library's search engine. They do have 87 books in that library under Shakespeare. Now, the vast majority of these are not by William Shakespeare. They're, I guess there's a new genre of kind of making pop novels out of Shakespeare tales. Most of them are that, or things like No Fear Shakespeare, which is not Shakespeare. They do not have a complete set of his works at this library. When you go to the home page of this library, here's what appears that communicates to you what this library is. Beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful libraries I've ever been to. First thing that comes up is the do-it-yourself rock painting event that's coming up. Then the canned food drive. Then there's the meeting of the Tuesday Knitting Club, which in fact is distinct from the Wednesday Club. I didn't want to spend enough time. Is it age difference or patterns? But there's two distinct knitting clubs. There's a meeting, and these are all on the webpage with sort of their own picture or their line. There's a meeting of the Mindfulness and Relaxation Club. There's a toddler play group. There's a senior coffee hour. There's a movie party coming up next week for the 4 years old and up group. There's a reception for a local artist. And on the webpage, there is 1 hour this week where books are being read to children. Everything else has nothing to do with books, or what traditionally would be understood as what happens in a library. Now, I performed the same exercise in several other local libraries to see if the result would be different. It wasn't different at all. One library very close to us, when you go to their webpage, here are the images you see. First, an adult coloring group. Then a child's choral group. Then there are two pictures of NHPR interviews that were held at the library. Then there's a picture of the snare drumming jam session. And then there's a picture of a child who looks to be about 2 or 3 years old, putting his finger on a tablet. That's it. That's the full cycle. I watched it twice. Of when you go to the landing page, that's what a library visually means. When I go to the consortium, which is a consortium of about 12 to 14 libraries in the most populated part of southern New Hampshire, and I start typing things in, here are some things I discover. When I type in Romeo and Juliet, it takes until the sixth entry to find the play. Again, popular novels instead. When I type in Robert Frost, New Hampshire, let's see if Robert Frost's, which by the way is out of copyright, so there's no price problem buying Robert Frost, New Hampshire. How many public libraries in the consortium, how many copies of Robert Frost, New Hampshire are in the entire consortium? One. How many copies of Susan Collins' The Hunger Games? Of the book, I'm not counting DVDs or recording, 18. So the consortium has one copy of Robert Frost's New Hampshire, 18 copies of The Hunger Games. I'm not making an argument against The Hunger Games, but the contrast speaks for itself. Some of you may know Robert McCloskey. perhaps the most famous or one of the most famous children's authors from New England. Robert McCloskey's Make Way for Ducklings. If you've been to the Boston Commons, you know Make Way for Ducklings. The consortium, to my delight, has four copies left of Make Way for Ducklings. In contrast, it has 42 copies of SpongeBob SquarePants. Well, those things aren't too important to me, but religion is important. How many books in the consortium on Roman Catholicism? 12. If you type in the search witchcraft, you will discover 563 books. Now, I love history, and I've been disappointed in the local library's diminishment of local history books. So I decided I'll type in New Hampshire, see how many books on New Hampshire are in the entire consortium. 712. I thought that was pretty good. And then I thought, I heard a little voice say, try the word San Francisco. So, state of New Hampshire, 712 books in the consortium. San Francisco, 867. Boston Red Sox. Say you were a boy interested in the Boston Red Sox. 104 books. That's pretty good. It's not quite as many books as books for transgendered people. That's 123. Say you were interested in the Boy Scouts of America. Well, there are 42 books in the consortium. Let's say you're interested in LGBTQ. There's 261 books in the consortium. Lesbianism, 308. Masculinity, 106. Femininity, which is a category in the search engine, there are just no books in our consortium on femininity. Pornography, so there's 61 books, some of which are explaining why it's bad or going through the neuroscience of watching pornography, but not all. There's some pornography in the consortium. 61. Books on chastity, 5. Books on deer hunting in the state of New Hampshire, 19. Books on homosexual lifestyle, 248. How about this? If you take all the copies in the consortium of the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the Aeneid, the three great epics of the classical world, you will have 36 books and recordings. Let's say you're not interested in classical epic, but you like rap. There are 404 recordings and 86 books of rap poetry. Let's say you like G.K. Chesterton. There are actually 25 books of G.K. Chesterton in the consortium. That's not quite as many as Ellen DeGeneres, who has 29 books, but at least there are 25. Only 6 books of Fulton Sheen, but if you like Deepak Chopra, there's 92. There are 47 books on John Paul II. There are 12 books on Benedict. There are 82 books on Pope Francis. If you combine all those, they're the same as all the books in the consortium on the Dalai Lama. I have nothing against the Dalai Lama. One of the courses I teach at Thomas More is on Eastern religions. But the Dalai Lama versus the three most recent pontiffs on significance, or Tibetan Buddhists in the state of New Hampshire versus Roman Catholics in the state of New Hampshire who would be interested in presidential writers. 35 books by Bill Clinton, who wrote 5 books. 112 books by Barack Obama, who wrote 3 books. 31 books by Ronald Reagan, who has several dozen books under his name. Many of them are speeches. No books of Washington's writings in the consortium. 34 books of Lincoln's speeches and writings. Not a single volume of Teddy Roosevelt's 20 volumes of writing. Just not there. Now, I grant it, this is all just atmospheric. Just random. Atmospheric. But I believe that you can go ahead and run tests and the results will be very, very similar. There's something very different about libraries today than when I was a young man. There's something very different about the direction that librarians whom I like. I mean, the librarians at the libraries that have these really bad collections, I actually really like the librarians. They're really nice, sweet people. But the collections, the selections, are devastatingly bad, and they throw out books constantly. And it's a big lie, because my family and I have tested it, that they only throw out books that are not in circulation. Because for 10 years, we would trot our family down with all our children, and we would check out the maximum number of books to try to keep things like Curious George in the library, or Laura Ingalls Wilder, and that stuff was constantly being weeded out and being replaced by other books, which are not of the same quality. Why is this? I think a lot of it has to do with the American Library Association, which is behind the organization and selections of most libraries and most library policy. If you go to the American Library Association, because I don't want to engage in conspiracy theory, they're very upfront about what they do and their interests. Their number one interest is advocacy. Their number two interest is diversity. They take great pride in spending their resources and time on defending what they call political censorship and intellectual freedom. I find this hilarious that they say that they do this, given the kind of Maoist approach to destruction of literature and censorship that's been going on in our library system. Really? There's that much demand for witchcraft in our libraries. Nearly 600 books, but only 12 books on Roman Catholicism. When I was younger, they used to have and promote Children's Book Day. Now, I remember this as a little boy. Children's Book Day. Bring your child to the library, Children's Book Day. When I was in college and my mother started working in libraries, what became big was Banned Book Week, which initially was all about defending Mark Twain. That's not what they're defending anymore. It's usually transgender stuff, homosexual literature, really extreme radical politics. The latest, so we've gone one day, one week, the newest is the month of June. The American Library Association, and maybe you noticed it if you step foot in the library, now dedicates the month of June to trans. That's the trans month for LGB, etc. Again, should a library not have books on this? Should it not address that aspect of culture? I'm not making that argument. But a month on that? The American Library Association that says it's a great defender of political, preventing political censorship and intellectual freedom is serious in a way, in that you should know that they were one of two parties that opposed the U.S. Child Internet Protection Act, which mandated that schools and libraries, which took federal money, had to have filters which prevented pornography being accessible on computers that children used. The American Library Association opposed that. They lost their suit, but they opposed that. Last year, another thing that they're proud of, and so I use this as explaining their character, they got rid of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Award for Children's Literature. I don't know if you've ever read the Little House books, but Laura Ingalls Wilder was banished. She's been stripped. Her name has been stripped from that award because of her cultural insensitivity and the fear in children's minds when they read her books. I'm quoting from their own press release. So what should we do? I'll just skip to the end. What should we do? I suggest, first of all, that you have a little bit of skepticism towards me. And you do it yourself. You sit down on the internet, make a list of the 20 books that you love, type them into a consortium reading list and see what you find. And then make a list of 20 topics or books of things that you don't think are healthy for young people or society. Type that in and compare the lists. Spend at least an hour going through your own library's search engines to see what they have, to see how the search engine itself is structured to lead you to works. Again, I want to emphasize this. There was a copy of Romeo and Juliet, but the search engine doesn't lead me to Romeo and Juliet. It leads me to five other works before I get to Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. Second, go to the public library and hold them to their word. It's your tax money. It's actually an interesting exercise is all our budgets in the state of New Hampshire are online. You can look at every town's budget. You can see exactly how many dollars go to every library in the state of New Hampshire. It's significant, by the way. After emergency services, personnel, and usually debt service, it's the biggest. Now, librarians will say, but it's only 5 or 6%. Yes, but everything below that is incredibly decentralized and very small compared to the library. It's a big portion of the budget. Now, I kind of like that, to be frank. I like investing in libraries. But since it's built on property tax money, which is your money, go to the library and order books. Tell them what you're interested in. Most librarians truly are helpful. They want to help. Tell them the kinds of books you want to see in the collection. Make them restock it with good books that used to be there. Third, build your own library. Think about St. Thomas and his students with 138 books at their disposal. It's really quite simple to build a library. By my calculation, there are probably 1,000 good books that every decent reader should have. And you can purchase these books for probably about $5 a book. It's pretty easy over the course of 20 years if you want to actually read the book while you're building the collection, unlike me, where I buy the books and then read them later. You might have to spend $200-$400 a year on a library. That's about half what Americans spend on takeout food. It's a little bit more than we spend on coffee. It's worth it. Build a library. And as you build it, remember the story about Aristotle. It was the private collections that saved Aristotle, not the public collections. Remember the whole story of Western civilization. It was the small libraries, not financed by governments, that were the repositories of learning. And if you have a political inclination, go political and politely confront your librarians. Tell them you'd like to establish a reading group in the library. See what they say. See what they say if you'd say, I'd like to have a Roman Catholic reading group in the library. Just go through the experiment. My guess is there will be some that would resist you, but some would probably say, oh, we've never had such a request. And they would do what people do in bureaucracies. They would put it into the process of approvals, and that might take a while. But it might actually turn out that you could have a Roman Catholic reading group at a public library. If you can have witchcraft in the library, how can a Roman Catholic group be wrong in the library? We have to remove all the books. And quite to be honest, the 12 books that we have in the consortium on Roman Catholicism, I'd be happy to say to the state, get rid of all books on religion and lose those 12 if we could also get rid of the 560-odd books on witchcraft. The last thing is perhaps the most radical. Start your own public library in the old sense of that word. There's absolutely nothing that prevents a group of friends saying, let's pool our resources together and create a library around a scouting group that hasn't been corrupted, a parish where you can rest assured that they're not going to throw out the books, someone's house, rent space. This is actually how libraries started and how they ran for most of American history. It's only the last century to century and a half where public libraries look vaguely the way they do. Prior to that, the previous 2,000 years, libraries were owned, stocked, cared for, loved by communities, families, colleges, schools. They were held privately. They were not held by the state. But the American tradition, the democratic tradition, is a little different than most of Western civilization. So first, you're already paying for the books. So go on down to Merrimack or Nashua or Hollis, wherever you live, and see if you can't get some of your tax money to fund good things rather than knitting clubs, rock painting societies, etc. So I've probably gone beyond my time a little bit, and I notice a lot of people fanning, so I will stop. But I'm very happy to be challenged or to chat about the subject. Thank you. I can take questions.
You take questions?
Yeah, how about 10 minutes of questions?
Right.
I mean, people don't have to stay. You can get up and have cheese. But I noticed a couple people put up hands right away, so yes.
Can you repeat the one sentence? The Greeks had the libraries, but they couldn't sustain them. And then the Romans?
Yes, so... Sure. Let me see if I can tie all that together. So you've got, in my retelling of this, two library traditions in our civilization. One that's dominant in the Eastern Mediterranean. By the way, it's what's absorbed by Islam. And one that's more the Western Mediterranean. And the big difference is in the Eastern Mediterranean with the Hellenistic Greeks, not the classical Greeks, the Hellenistic Greeks and Islam, the idea is to create fantastic centers of learning. Baghdad had a similar marvelous, the House of Wisdom, for a couple hundred years, wonderful place. The Mongols wipe it out. Learning is crushed in the Middle East and never really fully recovered until the conquest of Constantinople when they could take all those books. So the Eastern tradition is a tradition of concentration. The Western tradition is a tradition of decentralization. Benedict, Pope Benedict's insight is something that ennobles and maybe fuels, animates, preserves, but somehow changes that Western tradition, which I think is good on its own, on the natural level, decentralization, is the Hebrew-Christian relationship to God, which is mediated through the Word. And by Christians, God is understood as the Word. And so because words and reading are so very important in Christianity, not merely the reading of sacred texts, but of all learning, there's a theological underpinning in Christian culture that isn't present except as an echo in secular non-Christian culture. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. Couldn't quite get that in one sentence. West, good. Yes.
And we've inherited that from him and from Regensburg.
Yes, he speaks wonderfully in the Regensburg address about the difference between the East and the West and the approach based on this unity of faith and reason and opening things up to kind of a rational conversation and the importance of learning in developing the conversation around the most important issues in our life.
Yeah, so thank you very much for this. Very interesting. First, in your kind of telling of the grand sweep of history of the origin of libraries and whatnot, and I noticed that you jump from Alexandria to the decentralized monasteries who are popping up in the midst of a chaotic German-invaded West. And you didn't talk at all about Constantinople, which to me is really central in all of this, where, you know, the rise of Islam does not mean the end of Christian civilization in the East. The empire is still kicking for quite some time. And there will be no Renaissance, for example, if it weren't for the preservation of many of the texts, as I'm sure you know, right, in the East. And I think that I'm not sure if the Constantinopolitan model really fits into that binary of massive centralization versus massive decentralization.
No, you're right.
Plus, there's a much higher degree of literacy in the East during that time period. Now, St. John Chrysostom has a famous sermon he gives in Antioch where he's telling the people, you know, you have to read the scriptures at home, and you wives, don't rely on your husband, you have to read them too, right? I mean, no sermon like that could be given in 4th century Gaul, right? So that's just one comment. And the second had to do with the litany of books that were present in libraries versus those that are not. And one thing place of the old, right? So could you argue that? And again, obviously the ALA is populated by progressives, and that's, I mean, obvious. But isn't there always this kind of built-in bias towards the new? If it were not, wouldn't we have to talk about lost works of Archimedes or the plays of Euripides that aren't extant and whatnot? And how much of this is just the natural tendency of human beings, which is exacerbated in a democratic age, to prefer the new to the old? And as corollary to that, unlike past generations, I do have access to any book that I want. They're cheaper than ever. I mean, I can tell you, when Amazon started, my library attendance dropped because it's so easy to get anything I wanted. You know, going to the library is fun, but then you go and they don't have a book you want. Well, I can get any book I want. That's part of my library now for, as you said, very little. So I wonder if you could talk about this kind of, and this is a problem in civilization. I think it's a problem, a fundamental problem in democracy, the preference for the immediate. I think that's something that's a democratic tendency. But I wonder how you think that plays into the problem facing
Libraries. So which of the four things would you like me to? Yeah. I mean, St. John Chrysostom is part of the United Empire, and he's in a large city that gets crushed. Your peasant and your literacy levels in Byzantium versus the West are not different at all. And the West pretty quickly is going to outflank in broad learning the East. Some of that is thanks to the East falling. You're right, the Byzantine state has an interesting mixture of some degree of concentration in Constantinople, but Constantinople was never kind of mega concentration for learning, and a lot of decentralization in the Greek monasteries following the monastic model. Now, the more interesting question, isn't there always this quest for the new, this impulse to... I can't remember exactly how
you...
Preference for novelty. Is there? I mean, certainly humans like to develop things. They like working. But there's a difference between, say, developing within a tradition and rushing after novelties because it's new, without sort of thinking through, why do I want this new bauble? And there, part of what I left out of the talk was reading two long quotations by one person I like and one person I don't like. The person I don't like is Machiavelli, but he has a beautiful description of walking into a library. And he essentially says, I walk off the streets, I put off my soiled robes, I finally get to sit down and have a couple hours where I'm communing with the past, and they're communing with me, and I'm becoming wiser. And I ask them, why do you do the things that you do? Why did you do that? I don't like Machiavelli, but I think he has a beautiful vision of what a library is and the experience of being in a library, communing with those who are wiser who came before us. Would he have liked the printing press more? More printed editions of more authors from the past? Yes. But the impulse is different than the other quotation. The other quotation was from John Palfrey, who was the headmaster at Phillips Academy in Andover and is the chairman of the Digital Public Library of America project and wrote a book that, if you want to read books on libraries, I highly recommend, Bibliotech. John Palfrey's just that Maureen Mooney arranged for John Palfrey to speak when he was still here. He's now left New Hampshire, to speak to a Rotary group on libraries. And the quotation from John Palfrey is the vision he has for the new Boston Public Library. And that vision is all the languages. It's teen-friendly. And there are coffee stations. It's exciting. There's activity going on. There's movies. There's spaces for all this kind of interaction and discussion. No discussion of books at all. And he himself will pull to the side and say, it kind of kills me because I'm of the generation that loves books, but I'm afraid the libraries are going to become irrelevant. So there's this incredible anxiety that I don't understand amongst librarians who empirically, if you look at their control of budgets, talk about being squeezed academics are really good about talking about not having enough money. But if you look empirically at their budgets, they got loads of money. If you walk into these libraries, they're monuments to waste. They're monuments to waste. And the proof of that is they put into a brown paper bag the complete hardback Yale edition of Shakespeare, which occupied maybe this much shelf space, which they currently have in this library. And they replaced it with things like No Fear Shakespeare. And they didn't even get the No Fear Shakespeare for Julius Caesar. They've got money to burn in the libraries. But they're anxious about their relevancy. So they have knitting clubs. They paint rocks. They have toddlers groups. Right? There's a now, I think you hit it right on the head. There is something about modern democratic society that's just unhappy and restless. And there's something about this that makes us all very nervous. Because all of us who have one of these always wonder, do I have a message? Am I connected? Is there something interesting going on? And having spent 25 years in the academy, to watch how this thing has come in and how it tracks, I'm not saying it's causal, but it tracks with the skyrocketing of student anxiety, student wanting to belong but not knowing what that means, not being able to be in any kind of normal, natural human relationship without just going out of your mind, but constantly doing this. I'm at a great books college. It irritates me to see my students do this. They're starting to do that. I feel terrible until I go to a state university or go down to the Harvard Library, and people like this. It's even worse. But that only means it's coming to me. This, I've got more books right there than the Library of Alexandria. And I'm not a wise person because of that. I'm not a calm person because of that. So there's something, I can't perfectly connect it, but you add this culture to a radicalized democracy in modern America to all kinds of problems, quite frankly, related to sexual identity and identity politics, and the libraries are a giant mirror of American society. But it's a mirror tilted by the person holding it. And we shouldn't pretend that there aren't people that direct bad culture, so-called bad culture. And those people can be found right in the American Library Association. They're not like your local librarians. They are radical ideologues who have a very specific agenda, and they're constantly sending out pamphlets and emails on what to do and think. I'm
because
sure you're
that's
right.
What they read now.
Yeah.
At the school that I work, they read the graphic novel. They don't read the Odyssey proper. With that said, what I observe in kids today, do you think that we are heading to a post-literate culture? And by that, I don't mean people not being able to read and write, but people who have lost the ability to actually read and engage with the large ideas that have created Western civilization. Do you think that's
what I think we're there.
We're
going. Oh, I don't think we're going. I think we've arrived. There are many, many things wrong with the culture, and you put it, I think you put it just right. It's not that there won't be people who know how to read. It's not that we're going to lose books. You look at book production, and it's going through the ceiling. But books are cheap, and cheap things are not valued.
Students do not want.
Right. They don't, and I honestly think they don't have the capacity, they don't have the habits, and their neuropaths have been habituated to this, and this is designed by people who study very carefully Atlantic City gambling casinos. This is designed to keep you looking at it and keep you stimulated and also and just kind of be moving around. We all know that. I'm not revealing anything that we don't participate in. The difference is if you're above, I don't know, somewhere maybe in the 40s, you can remember a time when this was not. This isn't still a newcomer in my mind. To my daughters, they carry it on them at all times. My sons probably can't imagine their parents not having a smartphone. It's a permanent extension of humanity now. We've got to figure out how to deal with it. Look at that. I'm distracted because the principal of a Catholic school just sent me an email, which I'm sure is very important.
As libraries expand into trying to do new things and push much more a radical ideology where children, as often ends up with children being mutilated, have public libraries run their course? If we can't change, and several of us here in this audience have tried to fight it out with our local library, if we can't change it, should we concentrate on choking them?
Yeah, my instincts, I'm a Benedictine oblate, my instincts are always, let's just go out into the country, form a small, tight community, and just let the cities fall, because they're just so beyond the pale, and we'll come back later. But I don't think that that's right. I don't think that that's right. And I don't think that's right because of Pope Benedict. I can't imagine someone... I mean, I think, well, big deal. This is a novelty to me. Cultural change, decline in morals, decline in educational standards, decline in the university. Pope Benedict, if you think about his lifespan, has seen a catastrophe like nothing since the fall of the Roman Empire. And yet he said to Catholics, Catholics need to be engaged in social media. He brought himself to sending a tweet. More not because he liked it, but to send a message. His words were, "This is the agora. Paul was a good Jew. For St. Paul to go into a Greek agora surrounded by statues of gods, his whole life had trained him to think, that's impure, bad, I'm filthy, I will not be able to communicate with God if I go there. He was transformed by Christ so that he could go into the agora, just like Peter was transformed so that he could engage with pagan culture. We've got to engage this, we have to engage the librarians. If we don't engage the librarians, there won't even be 12 books. I guarantee you there's going to be someone sitting in a library who's going to, like all of us who've been in libraries, find something by accident. Until they get rid of the books, there will still be that wonderful pleasure of going to look for one book and finding the better book by accident, by serendipity, by God's grace and providence. If we completely give up on the public libraries, then we're basically saying, first of all you people in the libraries are evil, wicked. We don't want to deal with you. But we're giving up on a very significant portion of the population. So my instincts are, let's you and I go up to North Conway, have our own library and community, but I don't think we're there. I still think I'm giving a talk for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture, not for the restarting of a new Christian culture. So no, I think there's still an opportunity to fight. And my experience is those of us who are faithful, I think, are shell-shocked. And we think no one else is faithful, except when we're in a situation like this. My wife and I were down at a hospital. She was getting some iron infusions. And we were sitting there. We're in a Massachusetts hospital. We're thinking everything's secular there. And the nurse with us noticed my wife's copy of Magnificat. Just saw it. And said, "What is that?" Then was the great moment. Okay, Christian, are you going to say what that is? Or it's a book. My wife got it out. She said, oh, this is Magnificat. It has, I say my prayers in the morning in this. Oh, that's like a breviary. Well, this woman was a Roman Catholic, doesn't have any Roman Catholics to talk to. Ended up talking about what it's like being a Catholic in the hospital, was really encouraged to see my wife with that. But I think there are more people than we realize who are just told, you've got to be quiet by the dominant society. The dominant society is what we see on, you pick your least favorite news media. That's what is allowed to be discussed. That's what we discuss. That's what upstanding Americans discuss. And your stuff, no, you're a throwback Neanderthal if you do. But I actually don't think the majority of Americans are that way. I think they're shell-shocked. And they need Christian witnesses, and they need someone to go in and say, hey, why don't you have any good books on this subject? Why did you get rid of, I want to read, you know, Julius Caesar. That's a really interesting story about tyranny and what happens to a society in tyranny. Can you get me a copy? Yes. That's good, and you don't know in the long run what kind of impression that has on her. I mean, you talk about being valiant, and we have to be brave as Christians in public. We also have to be as wise as serpents. And the reality is, we all have jobs somewhere. We hope those jobs stay. Librarians want their jobs. They're guardians of their budget. For them to exist, they need to keep spending money. So don't be afraid if you want to go to a public library to incentivize the reality for them. The reality is they have to spend money. Why not give them some incentives on spending money? Again, this is why I think the idea of, hey, I represent 20 people who live in the town of X. We'd like to have this reading group, but we need more resources. Can you help us? Huh. That person could be a Freemason, and they're going to think, gold mine! I can put a new line item in the budget, support the nut job Catholic reading group. That's fine by me. And you just never know over time where there might be an unusual friendship, a breakthrough, someone who's not what you think they are. Now, I'm not saying some people are truly lost and are truly hostile, and you have to be aware of that, but most people actually aren't. And you perfectly described a reference library. They want to go and fetch the neat book. That's what they're trained to do. They love that. They love getting a response from people. Yes, we've got your resource. And that's a good thing. That's a kind of example of an institutionalized Christian virtue of hospitality. That's how we should think of it. Let's give them opportunities to be hospitable.
Express your feelings in front of your classmates, lest you're going to be reported for having the wrong thought. That's going to isolate everybody, and that scares the hell out of me. And I don't know how to stop it. I need people to run for school board in November, or I'm going to quit because I'm like 3 against 6, and I need to up that number. And I'm banging my head against the wall. It gets doable. If we have 5, I can flip this city. To common sense. But we sit back and we let it happen. I think you could do the same for the library. I don't think there's any intellectuals in that library that know what curriculum they're picking. There might be a few, but I think there's monetary incentives.
So I pushed the limit with Dominic. he's got the cheese for us. So, thank you.